top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die, only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
From our downtown Trump headquarters, here is a special edition, solo edition, of the Really Awful Movies Podcast, 2017's The Killing of a Sacred Deer. And this is, of course, episode 306 for those of you who are following along at home. Now, I was trying to comport my thoughts regarding this film, and if this podcast is a little bit more free-flowing and extemporaneous than I might have otherwise intended, apologies as I'm going through my reflections in real time here, sans notes, so we'll see how cohesive and coherent I can be regarding this film, and to the extent that it even matters, given director Yorgos Lanthimos' approach to the subject matter as well. So this one is very, very critically lauded, receiving countless plaudits from critics who more often than not tend not to dip their toes into the brackish waters of the horror space. And this always sets me off and prejudices me toward thinking that their motives might not be in the right place. To wit, they frequently ignore mainstream releases and only deem certain releases worthy of their attention when they're, for lack of a better term, on the more art house or more pretentious side. And you could throw in Midsommar into that mix, although that one doesn't fly as close to the sun as maybe Lanthimos does with this effort, The Killing of a Sacred Deer, which stars Colin Farrell, Nicole Kidman, and Barry Keoghan in the lead roles. And there's also an appearance by everybody's favorite Batman and Robin, or maybe not, co-star Alicia Silverstone. Now, The Killing of a Sacred Deer is an interesting exercise tonally, and not being familiar with Lanthimos' work, previously, he came to the forefront with his film called The Lobster, which sounds like it would have something to do with maybe a noted Toronto psychologist, Dr. Jordan Peterson. But his directorial sensibilities are very, oddly idiosyncratic, to say the least, and not exactly the most audience-pleasing or beguiling aesthetic that the guy has, to put it mildly. I mean, this one is actively, I would say, antagonistic at times toward the audience, and this is brought forward through the characterizations that really don't match what in any way could be construed as anything approaching realism. Now, we take that with a grain of salt, because again, not everything has to be realism, and different horror films devise different means of aesthetic approaches depending on what kind of milieu they're trying to occupy. Now, obviously, the Italians are famous for creating otherworldly experiences and tonalities that, and I'm thinking Argento's Inferno, where you have a very dreamlike quality and characters seem to be floating through time and space in a way that is pretty much unrecognizable from a realistic standpoint. You could throw the Suspiria, both original and the, I would say, misbegotten or misguided remake in that regard. So you have an otherworldly conceit, and with Argento, he has otherworldly characters to inhabit this. Now, by contrast, The Killing of a Sacred Deer has a very very stark and very muted approach, and the characters speak in very stilted and very deliberate, measured, clipped tones, which I'm emulating right now as if they're, I mean, whacked out on psychotropics, to be honest. And this is fine if you want to, I guess, envelop the film, you know, envelop these characters with an equally otherworldly environment, which this one really doesn't. It almost reminds me of one of those architectural documentaries you see on Netflix that celebrates strange, stark, and examples of modern art in which the architect incorporates elements of the background into the foreground and creates living spaces out of the likes of maybe rock spaces or forests or farmers' fields and whatnot. Like, there's an austere quality to the film, and that's not to say it's not incredibly beautiful. We have these wonderful wide-angle shots, cinematography was by Thiomos Bakatakis, and it's stunning. I mean, it's beautiful stuff, but when you have, I guess a realistic backdrop, and you have characters that are so unreal, standing in stark relation to that, it can be a little bit off-putting. Now, the plot of this one doesn't really lend itself to this kind of thematic juxtaposition either. I mean, you have a skilled cardiothoracic surgeon, and that's Stephen Murphy, Dr. Murphy, who's married to another doctor. I forget her specialty. I think it's not something in the surgical realm, but he's played by Colin Farrell, and his home life with Nicole Kidman is... I mean, it's hinted at that their marriage is in some kind of severe decay, but not much is really drawn out about that. I mean, they speak with one another very, very matter-of-factly and very tersely in a kind of a waspy way that I think was somewhat brought to the forefront in with the likes of Get Out, where you have people who are wearing masks, metaphorically speaking, and they're not really, you know, that there's more to their mien and to their backgrounds than meets the eye. You would almost have to, because you have to question immediately their kind of bizarre home life and the way they interact with their children in a very, Asian tiger mom style, where they impose incredibly strict, discipline on their kids, who have to water the plants and walk the dog in a very regimented, rigid way. So this is the kind of environment that we're set up and meant to be caring about. So you have the twosome, and then you have the teenage kids, and then you have the introduction of a character. It was played by Barry Keoghan, who's a wonderful Irish Dublin-born actor, and he's inserted into this family drama, this almost dark Ibsen-esque drama, in that he is frequently contacting Dr. Stephen Murphy and meeting him at his place of work, which is the local hospital, and they're engaging in this clandestine sotto voce discussions, which would lead the viewer to conclude, and this is not the case, but it would lead a viewer to conclude that maybe he is an actual member of the Murphy clan or a Murphy family, maybe a son that Dr. Murphy sired through infidelity or in a past marriage that he was trying to distance himself from. So that is actually not the case. So you are led down the garden path of something which is an interesting conceit and an interesting move at first. You're led down this path where you're consistently this relationship between the two. And again, it's very furtive, it's very secretive, Dr. Murphy and this kid. And that would be, let's see the character's name, I'm just going to look it up here. Martin, much like the excellent George Romero eponymous film, the vampire film of the same name. Martin is increasingly exerting influence in these people's lives, and it makes you wonder why in the hell he would do so. And these conversations are taking place in quiet hallways of the hospital, and it turns out, in fact, and this is not a spoiler, that Martin is in fact the spawn of a patient who met his end at the hands of, I mean literally at the hands of Dr. Murphy, who it turns out through, as you find out in the narrative, turns out had a severe drinking problem, which, as an aside, this doesn't do much in terms of Irish stereotypes here for the film, but when you have the two Irish leads in this film, and you've got the plot point, that everything pivots around a drinking problem. But that said, surgical prowess derived from hands, and having a steady hand on the wheel is absolutely vital for the profession. And it turns out that this, I can't recall the exact type of procedure that Martin's father had, but Dr. Murphy was an alcoholic who was drinking on the day of the operation, and this was revealed through the anesthesiologist. This was one of the incidents that has plagued Dr. Murphy for quite some time now, and to the point where he has actually kept in touch with Martin over the years. And it should be said as well that Martin's father was not only a patient of Dr. Murphy's, but also a colleague whom he held quite dear. So, what does this mean? Well, Martin begins to play a little bit of gamesmanship with Dr. Murphy. He's encroaching on their life. He basically invites him over to the Murphy household, and where there's various set pieces where he tries to ingratiate himself and into the household through by way of the Murphy's young daughter, and the two of them hit it off as in a romance that it should be said that the Murphys are not keen on thwarting, because they feel at the outset that he's maybe a good kid, and he's obviously very bright and very mature for his age. Soon, however, the Murphys find out that Martin is not one to be trifled with, and has a bit of an odd sense to him, an off-putting demeanor. And this manifests itself in his interactions with the Dr. Murphy in his office at the hospital, where they get into this prolonged discussion about puberty and body hair and who has more armpit hair and chest hair. It's very odd, very off-putting, and something that is, again, it's reiterated in a kind of matter-of-fact tone with this subject matter that you don't frequently see discussed in a film. And so you have Martin engaged in these odd discussions. He continues to press the Murphy family over about his mother maybe reciprocating the dinner offers. But when these overtures are not accepted, He becomes more and more insistent, and leading Dr. Murphy to eventually placate him and come over to the house, and basically advocates for and partly facilitates an awkward situation where his mother makes romantic overtures towards him, all as Martin actively encourages it. So it's a weird, odd, off-putting dynamic that's created, and this creates tension in the Murphy household as Martin again insists himself upon them and begins to increasingly insert himself in different ways. Now, a key turning point in the film is a redress that Martin tries to create. It's more than just atone for his father's death at the hands of Dr. Murphy, but a way to, I guess, make things equal and make things right. And as Judge Judy would say, make things whole again. And this is would be done in the act of balancing lives for life. Literally, I guess, an eye for an eye. And he gives, I mean, Dr. Murphy a choice insofar as it's more an option than a choice, because it's there's no free will whatsoever. But he gives Dr. Murphy a choice, if you want to call it that, of which family member he will have to sacrifice to make Martin whole and redress and address the death of his father at his hands. So, now, how this happens is a little bit different from what you'd expect, because this is not a pure blackmail play. This is not a home invasion play. A metaphorical home invasion, maybe, but this is not where you think this is going. In fact, Martin, as it turns out, has been poisoning the Murphy clan. And he, through some mechanism unexplained, and this is where a lot of holes open up in the narrative, Dr. Murphy's kids fall victim to various unexplained ailments, to which Dr. Murphy responds by demanding that they undergo a battery of different hospital tests, from PET scans to ECGs to you name it, and demanding upon his colleagues that the best and the brightest among them impose order on this kind of chaos by figuring out what's going on. And the symptoms are quite, it should be said, quite intense. So their kids, Kim and Bob, you know, they suddenly find that they can't make use of their legs. And so they end up crawling all around the house, and initially the psychologists and the psychiatrists at the hospital insist that these manifestations of symptoms are merely psychosomatic, that it's all in their head, but again, Dr. Murphy is a skilled medical practitioner as well. He doesn't quite buy it, so he continues against the press for what is going on. Martin then discloses that the Murphys will slowly die after a certain number of stages are passed through if Dr. Murphy doesn't kill a member of his own family. And paralysis is the first stage, followed by self-imposed starvation, so something akin to what maybe Alzheimer's dementia patients face in later age, where the swallow reflex has been curtailed and cribbed, and they can no longer ingest food. But then there's something even beyond that that's more horrifying, which includes the Ebola syndrome-like bleeding from the eyes, which they somewhat wasted an opportunity to deal with this very terrifying physical ailment. But the filmmaker chose not to do that. And then finally, after this, comes death. Now, where the narrative falls a little bit short is for a man of science and a man who's whose entire being and revolves around imposing order on things that people don't understand, and that's frequently the disease metaphor. He himself is pretty dismissive of Martin's claims that he's been the mastermind behind these occurrences. Now, this is beyond silly, and the fact that he doesn't contact the authorities presents a huge plot point that, that Lanthimos and his co-writer, Ephismus Philippou, really, ignore, and they do so at their peril, because essentially all he does is, I don't know if this is not really well developed enough in his character, but Dr. Murphy is just in avoidance mode, just saying that Martin is full of shit, and with Martin reciprocating that, warning him that time is running out. So this leads to the kids arguing about who their father will choose, and whether killing the children is an actual option. So you have this Sophie's Choice kind of scenario working out in real time in the absence of the police. It's almost like The Nicole Kidman character and the Colin Farrell character were early advocates of defund the police. So this is a very strange conceit and something that really should have been addressed at least tangentially or somewhat. There's just there's a certain flatness that comes from the failure to address this in the narrative, and it leaves the viewer to really reach and grasp and conjecture about what possibly Martin could have done to create these kinds of physical ailments. And there's a reference to, continued reference to his fondness for lemonade and freshly made lemonade. And it's possible that that could have been a poison conduit or vehicle, but it's really not, I mean, there's not really any sense as to how Martin could have done any of these things. I mean, he's a smoker. He introduces daughter Kim to cigarettes as they have this brief and budding romance between the two. But it's not really, there's not really any kind of means as to how he could have done this. And that, again, it's just maybe this is just something to nitpick on, and you could just leave it open to interpretation and ambiguity. But given the profession of the protagonist, it's almost impossible to do this, because really, again, he's a man of science, and how, when these physical symptoms are so obvious, I mean, you have paralysis followed by inability to eat, this really narrows the possible diseases that they could possibly be diagnosed with. Again, the ambiguity could, in some circles, be seen as a kind of a good thing. When you compare it to other, let's say, medical horror films, and I recently podcasted Milo Ventimiglia star called Pathology, which is a very obvious medical procedural, shall we say. So obvious, in fact, that the Hippocratic Oath is quoted before the opening credits, which is the most obvious way to introduce a film about malevolent doctors. It's just really mind-numbingly inane. So, to its credit, The Killing of a Sacred Deer chooses to keep some things in the realm of the purely speculative and ambiguous. And, I mean, fine, that's all well and good, but it doesn't really jive with how the characters behave so matter-of-factly. They could have easily reached out to law enforcement, and again, they could have used their matter-of-fact communications to just involve someone else in the proceedings, but I guess that would have maybe possibly complicated the narrative. Now, critical response, as I said in the beginning, when something is so overwhelmingly lauded and by so many reviewers, it makes you wonder and makes you question their motivation, because they only really step down from their towers to review films that are deemed worthy of their time, right? So you're not going to get the latest installment of Final Destination or the latest Friday the 13th film reviewed by these numerous publications. So, I mean, when you look at Rotten Tomatoes, you have 268 reviews, which is phenomenal for a horror film that really generated minimal interest at the box office. I mean, 6 million is really a pittance. Now, Metacritic, the film has a weighted score of 73 out of 100 based on, you know, indicating generally favorable reviews. And to the extent anyone's able to put up with the bizarre and idiosyncratic tonal vibe of the film, in which the kids are the only ones who would behave in any kind of normal capacity, that will color your appreciation or non-appreciation of this effort. Now, in Bloody Disgusting, one of the reviewers gave it a 1-star, really uncharitable, saying that it had none of the intrigue and tension of The Witch at the time, and that the film was mechanical. And while the visuals were striking, they become monotonous and garish. It's really tough to say. I mean, the ability to create a very unique atmosphere and to do so with brilliant visuals, and in daylight to boot, is quite an accomplishment. To be able to create a terrifying and claustrophobic dynamic in largely what is daylight is usually left to the likes of Dario Argento in his exemplary author-centered work, Tenebrae. So he's able to do that with rich aplomb, but it's generally a very difficult task to do this. So Lanthimos does it impeccably here. So there's a very, clinical, which makes sense as per the subject matter, approach to some of the repartee and the dialogue, very factual, very clipped, and some very striking, impersonal and architectural digest, modernist style cinematography. But then you have these oddly behaving, muted characterizations, and this is juxtaposed with a very almost straightforward procedural, a police procedural type film, or at least it should have been, and it's very odd to have that play out the way it did. So I'm not sure this would be the point in the podcast where we get to what we've learned, but I guess so, since I have no one here to tell me otherwise. But what I learned is that there's a very kind of affected art house, with a capital A, pretense that this, almost a film school pretentiousness that this film has. An example of which can be the sexual dynamic between the doctor and Dr. Mrs. Murphy, in which the Nicole Kidman character has to mock that she's undergone anesthesia in order to have her husband get off. And it's such a silly, pointless exercise of, I don't know what exactly, but it's something that would be very obvious and just a way to appear weird for the sake of being weird, for weirdness' sake. To quote Hunter S. Thompson, when the going gets weird, the weird turn pro, and it's no sense, doesn't add anything to the proceedings, and it's just a way for Lanthimos to just inject some unnecessary oddness to a film. Now, star rating. When it comes to this one, it's going to be really tough because there's a huge chasm in the middle that should have been addressed and wasn't, and that's going to remove several stars, and one could say that was enough to make this viewer not give this a wholehearted recommendation, but there's still enough meat in here that you can't help but enjoy some of the aesthetic choices he makes, and it'd be enough of an enticement to go check out The Lobster as well. So I'm going to give this one a solid 3 out of 5. And we'll be back shortly with another episode of the Really Awful Movies podcast, and we'll talk to you soon. Thank you.